Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Thank you for coming to another episode of Energy in Action. I have named this episode The Rare Disease in the Room because I think that this is a tough conversation. It's talking about these diseases with children, whether it's their own disease, whether it's a sibling's condition, whether it's their parent or grandparent. These are tough conversations to have. And maybe there's some inclination from the child already that there is an issue there. So I welcome today Danielle Eves Hernandez. She is a certified child life specialist and recreational therapist for Community Peds Care in Jacksonville. They are so lucky to have you. Danielle has worked in pediatric palliative care and hospice care since her graduation from University of Florida. She went on to obtain her master's in public health from the University of North Florida. She has had the privilege to work with hundreds of patients and families to support children through the language they speak, which is play, so that they can best cope with the medical conditions in their family. She advocates for patients and siblings to understand their complexities, to have control in their lives and retain their childhood, despite how these overwhelming situations can pressure them to grow up so quickly. Danielle believes in the power of health education. She believes in play, and she believes in the resilience of children and their families. And we need to help our families be best supported by a team of medical professionals. And she does an amazing job with that. And we are so lucky to have her on the show. So welcome, Danielle.
Thank you for having me, Marcy. I appreciate it.
So we're going to set up a couple scenes of, you know, just different scenarios. And I'd love for you to kind of go in depth on how you've handled it, how you would handle it. This episode is really, it hits home for me. As everyone knows, I suffer from a mitochondrial condition and my kids don't know. And they're getting older and I have such mixed feelings about talking about it with them. I grew up with such fear. My mom was much more advanced at my age than I am right now, but I knew there were issues. She wasn't diagnosed yet, but I knew there were so many medical issues. I wish I could have understood more, but I also, was there a blessing in not understanding? You know, when I asked her if I would have the health issues that she currently has, she would always say no. But at that time, she didn't know we had a genetic disease, you know, running through our family. But I did have issues seeing my mom and my grandma be so much worse off physically than their contemporaries. And I'm scared of not talking to my kids and I'm scared of talking to my kids. So I thought we could unpack that one first. And then we're going to talk about, you know, other family relationships after that. What do you think?
I think those feelings that you're having are absolutely valid. And everything you've gone through with your family previously has brought you to this place of the trauma that you went through with your grandma and your mom. That is very real and has shaped who you are as a person. And then your own diagnosis and, you know, dealing with that as a patient and also as a daughter and a granddaughter of someone impacted by a serious health condition. And now wondering as a mother, if your children are going to have it or be carriers and pass it on, that's a lot to unpack. So that is like an onion of many layers, Marcy. So I'm sorry that your family has gone through all that and can absolutely appreciate like your concerns and disclosing that to your children now. And so I honestly have learned just so much from working with families since 2008. Over the last 15 years, I just have been honored to walk the sacred ground in pediatric palliative care and hospice. And honestly, when I first came to Peds Care as a brand new child life specialist, I didn't really know what a mitochondrial condition was until one of my very first patients I met in 2008 had a mitochondrial condition, and she had a trach and a vent, and she had very much been impacted by this condition at that point. She was bedbound. She was still able to move her hands somewhat. She could talk. She could shake her head yes and no. She could, you know, mouth words over her trach and kind of whisper. But to explain a mitochondrial condition is sometimes very vague, because even how each family member is impacted can look different. So I think I always start when talking with children and young adults as to what they understand a situation is. Like, hey, do you understand, you know, like, tell me about mom. And, you know, they might say, oh, well, she likes to do this. She likes to do this. Sometimes she has to rest, or sometimes she's clumsy, or sometimes, you know, my dad takes us to soccer practice instead. Like, they recognize the change in their routines and how, you know, as younger children, how it impacts them, like how their caregiver's condition or their schedule changes, or the people who are doing things for them are impacted. But then as they become older and more socially aware, they really understand, like, hey, she might seem sad, or she might seem kind of, I don't feel like they're telling me the whole truth. Or maybe they kind of understand more about the death of, like, your mom or your grandmother than they did when they were younger. Like, I know we had discussed, like, hey, when they learn, like, 60 is really young for somebody to die, like, that then those kind of conversations might come to be that otherwise didn't when they were 5. And so I think I always encourage families to do what they're comfortable with, but trying to encourage everyone to come together. Like, I feel like a lot of times families will not disclose the full truth because they're trying to protect one another, right? So everybody's kind of like in their own corners because they don't want to make the other upset or scare them or, you know, like worry them too much. But then when we do that, it kind of can be isolating and further like ostracize or isolate, like, hey, we can't talk about this, or it's kind of taboo, or sometimes the unknown is even scarier than what the truth is. And so being able, like, a goal of mine is, how do we help support families kind of turn in from like their four corners into the middle of the room to kind of talk about the elephant in the room? And so sometimes that's baby steps. Like, you don't have to sit down and have like a huge conversation all at once. But a lot of times it's just starting with, hey, this is the situation in our family. Sometimes I have to go to the doctors to get my, you know, lab work checked out. And this is why, like, and then you can kind of share about some of the symptoms you might have, and then kind of ask them what their questions are or their wonders or fears, and then take it from there. And when these conversations happen, like, a lot of times as a child life specialist, I'll give families tools and language to use, but a lot of times I'll help be part of that conversation if it's something that the family doesn't feel fully comfortable in doing it, but they definitely want to disclose, then we will kind of work through that together. And I think that's important. Something else I do a lot of times is bibliotherapy. So I have a couple of my favorite books right here, and one of my favorite ones that I'll start with is kind of really benign, is called Is a Worry Worrying You? And so I'll read it with kids, like, usually, you know, school age kids is a good one for, and we're able to just talk about, like, what concerns do you have? Like, sometimes it's, you know, am I fitting in at school, or I worry if I'm going to get a good grade or make the varsity team, or, you know, things like that. But other times it's, I worry about my loved one. And then we're kind of able to unpack that in a non-threatening manner. And so that's a good one. And then when we get to talking about an actual condition, especially mitochondrial disorders, because they are kind of vague. Like, we learned, okay, it's the powerhouse of the cell, but then past that, everybody's like, I don't know what that means. And it's kind of a big word, and just this, like,
and I don't know what it's going to look like for me, you know, moving forward, you know, and I don't want to go based off of my mom.
Right. And so that's okay to say, you know, we don't know. And we, and talking about the things we hope for and how, like, your condition was caught a lot earlier than theirs was, and how science is a lot farther along now than it was when they were, you know, alive or first getting diagnosed. So I think those are all things to say, like, it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to cry together. It's okay to say, I don't know. And really then letting them kind of lead the conversation. And also recognizing, like, kids take things and compartmentalize it. So, like, they'll receive information. They'll think about it. They'll be like, okay, cool. And then they'll go play and act like everything's normal. And families will be like, what? Do they not understand the magnitude of what I just told them? And they may or may not, but, like, they take it in parts and then they'll chew on it. Like, they'll, you know, they'll put it away. They'll chew on it. And then, you know, at bedtime, you might get a conversation from, like, your 11-year-old who's like, hey, I've been thinking about what you said, like, a week later, and they will come back and ask more about it once they've kind of processed it in their own way. And I think, too, like, whenever you have conversations like that, or just in general with family members or the community, like, being open, keeping it as an open-ended conversation, right? So it's not just this doom and gloom conversation you sit down once and have for half an hour and then that's the end of it. It's constantly ongoing. And, like, then giving yourself permission to say, hey, I'm really tired today. Like, I just need a break. Or, like, hey, if you could help me by doing this tonight, like, I'd really appreciate it. Like, I don't want you to feel pressure, but I just want you to know that, like, I'm just tired today. That doesn't mean anything's wrong. It just means my cells aren't behaving today.
I like that. My cells aren't behaving today.
Yeah. You know, you can kind of equate it. A lot of times I'll equate it to a battery too. Yeah. So, I mean, everybody can appreciate, like, their iPad or their phone battery, right? Like,
for sure.
Even when you're fully charged with mitochondrial condition, you aren't operating at 100%. So, like, now that your kids are older, you could be like, hey,
I'm speaking their language if I go in that direction.
Right? Like, hey, I'm operating at 100 today. It's a great day. Like, let's go do something fun today. Like, give them a yes day. Like, what do you want to go do today? And so that'd be really great. But then when you're not having, you're like, hey, I'm operating at 50%, guys, like, lights are on, but nobody's home. Or
that means that maybe you unload the dishwasher and you take out the trash. And when I say to do something, I do wonder, you know, will they learn empathy?
Right.
You know, through my condition. I'm so scared of ruining their carefree childhood. You know, my mom was so much more worse off at when she was my age. But I'm not doing great. Let's, you know, not.
Right.
And let's not, you know, paint an incorrect picture. But I was so scared of something happening to her. And part of me wonders, you know, if I can keep it as invisible as possible, will I give my children a better childhood? And I battle with that.
Of course. Of course you do. That's your mama bear instinct, yeah. Right? You want to protect them from that. But I think once you do disclose, like, when you feel the time is right, like, there will kind of be a relief that comes from it.
100,000%.
And so I think that that's okay. And I think it also teaches the message to kids that, hey, we don't have to go through scary things alone. Like, we go through things together as a family, and whatever we face, the good, the bad, the ugly, or the in-between, like, we're going to go through this together. And so, you know, just being able to say, hey, there's a lot of unknowns, but we know that, like, when things got really bad with my mom or with Nana, that we saw her body getting worse and worse and worse. Right now, things have been really good with mine, and we think I'm in a really good place. We don't think I'm dying. Like, that'll be one of the questions that will automatically come from kids is, so are you going to die or are you dying? Like, and being able to say, hey, no, I'm not right now. You know what I mean? Like, one day this could kill me, but right now we are not anywhere near that. But yes, this is what killed them at that time. And at that time, they did not have the support or the technology that we do now.
Obviously, you're right. A mama bear always has fear, you know, and these fears are so multiplied when there's such a scary, you know, disease involved in all of it. But I think that, you know, I want to come around to it. I think it would be healthier to talk to them about it, especially as they are getting a little bit older. Do you think that there's worry of like a compounding trauma, like hearing this if they've already gone through like a death, you know, if someone close to them has already passed away and they've gone through something like that, which unfortunately my kids did last year? Is there fear that, you know, I'm putting too much on them because they've also gone through something else?
I think it actually helps support them through the loss of their grandmother, because then you can have those open conversations of, you know, this was the condition that she died from, but that doesn't mean I'm dying right now or anytime soon. And that, you know, this isn't anything like you can catch like COVID,
yeah.
But this is something that can be passed down in through the family. And so right now, you know, your bodies aren't showing us any signs of that. When you're older, you know, the doctors are able to test you if there were any concerns, and then we take it from there. But right now we do not believe that you have it at this time. And, you know, that's something we will always keep our eyes on. So it's also important for you to let me know if you notice any changes in your body, like if you're having muscle weakness or, you know, you're getting tired very quickly or some of the symptoms that your disease manifests in. I think it's also important for them to kind of just have some open communication, like, hey, this is not at all, you know, on our forefront right now, but it is something that we want you to be open with us in, you know? So you don't have to go there right now about them possibly having it. I think right now you disclose.
They'll bring up the idea.
Yeah, they will. They will. Especially like being 11, you know, that 11-year-old, I'm sure, will probably put some more pieces together. But and with the fact that you had, you know, your mom and your grandmother, but that I think just reinforcing too, that it's okay to ask questions. It's okay to talk about them. It's okay. Like, I miss her. Like, I really wish this didn't happen. Like, and I think being able to grieve together gives them, that's a really beautiful permission to being able to support one another through that loss. And so I think that is just showing them that we face scary and sad together, in addition to the happy.
I feel like we could talk about this for so many hours, you know. Let's talk about, you know, a different family scenario where there is a child that the disease is not invisible, you know, and it's manifested in ways that other people, strangers can see and your whole family can see. And there are siblings in the family, and, you know, talking to them is going to be much different, but they also really need to be cared for, and there needs to be mental space, you know, dedicated to them. What advice would you have to give to those families in that, more in that position?
Sure. So I've had several throughout the years just working with families with these rare mitochondrial conditions where they have had multiple children affected. And so I've had four families who have had multiple children with the same mitochondrial condition. Oftentimes they had already had, you know, multiple children, and then they found out one had it, and then next thing they know, the younger ones test for it, or a new baby tests for it later in life. And it's really difficult to get that diagnosis again or to find that out. And so we always, the way I approach it is again, just like child-led, helping them to understand like, hey, why does, you know, your brother have to go to the hospital so often? Like, what's going on with G right now? I have a family who they actually have 10 children and they have a rare form of mitochondrial disorder called leukodystrophy. And so that is where the brain actually gets white matter lesions. And depending on where those lesions come up, depends on what part of the body is affected. So it's, I kind of equate it to like a slow, like ALS or muscular dystrophy, where they kind of, you know, start off just being clumsy. And so like this young man, the oldest of the children, when he was about 7 or 8, started like tripping and falling a lot. He started like choking on his food when he would eat his SpaghettiOs or his Mountain Dew. And he was just kind of like, then his speech got a little slurred. And so then at that time, his family like kept going to the doctor. They were trying to figure out what was wrong and finally got genetic testing. And when they had the genetic testing done, then that's when they discovered this. And then there were already several siblings at that time. There are two sisters who have it as well. And then the youngest son also has it. And the girls are very stable. They actually were kind of low toned. They were just really tiny babies, like kind of failure to thrive. They didn't gain a lot of weight. So they ended up having G-tubes and they got a lot of fluids just to help with their fatigue and weight. And they're doing really well. Like actually both of those sisters are now in their teens. They're working full time. Like they're in school, they're leaving a very, you know, kind of normal life. However, the oldest son and the youngest son are very impacted. The young man is now in his mid-20s and very affected, total care on a trach. He's on oxygen a lot of the time. He has a central line. He has to have TPN, like he cannot tolerate G-tube feeds anymore. So I've watched a very slow decline with him. And then the youngest brother was a baby when I first met him, like just a few months old. And now he's 10. And he's just kind of become more clumsy and having like losing weight. His speech is getting worse. His vision's kind of getting like his eyes kind of turning inward a little bit, and he has to hold things up closely, but he's very free-spirited and won't wear his glasses. So like that's difficult. But he understands, like he sees the total care, and like all the other siblings, right, that I work with, they see the oldest brother in and out of the hospital a lot, and all the equipment and daily care that actually the oldest siblings all help and act as nurses for him, just with his day in, day out needs, in addition to the mom and what few nurses they can actually get in the home, just due to the national crisis of nursing shortages in the home. So it's really impacted their entire family on so many levels, because they see their oldest brother, they see the youngest brother like having issues. So we play like with those youngest siblings, especially, we have played hundreds of hours of doctor with my medical puppet that has a feeding tube and a central line, and it has a trach too, and they like do all of G's care on the puppet, and PJ is the puppet's name, and like they'll run out to the car and get PJ and bring him in, and basically act out everything that they witness happen to G on the puppet. And it's really important to give them that outlet where they have control. We're able to identify the misconceptions that they have or their worries, and we're able to openly talk about like their fears as to what's going on with them. And the youngest is able to talk about, you know, what's happening to his body. And so he takes it in small doses, like his attention span, he'll come in and out of some of the play. And then other days he's in there playing the whole time. And so just respecting that children compartmentalize that and then giving them the space to come back and talk about it another time, I think is really important too.
To be able to get them to, in a play fashion, to be able to get them to be asking questions that are so on their level that, you know, they must be so lucky to have you.
Oh, well, thanks.
What should a family ask for? I mean, I want all families in the mitochondrial community to have someone like you. So we can't clone you. So what should families ask for in terms of this type of care? Because this is all so important for the whole family's mental health. And it does go beyond, you know, the child with mitochondrial disease or the child with any rare condition, you know, and making space for those other siblings and their questions and their concerns it's a really big deal.
Sure. So I think absolutely asking what palliative care services are available where they live are a great place to start. So sometimes that's through their genetic clinic or their medical institution, or even through a local hospice or palliative care. You can find out resources also through nhpco.org, which is the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. You know, you can go on there and type your city and see what services are available to you and call those local providers if your medical community may have that in your area. However, that's not available everywhere yet. And so I think trying to find resources online through, you know, there's child life specialists who do outreach and do servicing and programming virtually. I think that's an option, or trying to talk with, you know, even nurses or social workers that are within those clinics that are servicing families with mitochondrial disorder. So whether that's a, you know, the genetic clinic or neurology or whoever your, you know, main pediatrician is, seeing if any of those providers can help you really explain that to your children, I think is important. Or even getting together nationally with some of these organizations like Mito Action to have that support, I think, is a great initiative and platform, like recognizing this is a need and how can we fill that gap to support these families. I think there's a lot of room for progress and support that clearly is so needed. And so I'd start, you know, with those institutions, and then even too, like just seeing about what therapy you can get your children involved in. Doesn't mean they need therapy for the rest of their lives, but giving them an outlet to just kind of check in with a mental health professional, like, okay, are they coping with everything, you know, all right? Like, they've got some big feelings. They're having a lot of anger. I'm seeing a lot of outbursts. I'm seeing changes in grades. I'm seeing a lot of sadness. Like, and that doesn't mean that emotions, the presence of emotions, indicates a problem. It just means that they are working through some really big life events. And so making sure that we are supporting them the best that we can and giving them that safe space to talk about it with somebody other than the family, because again, they're going to protect, just like you as mama bear trying to protect the cubs try to protect mama bear too. You know, if you do have a child with a mitochondrial disorder and they go to school, like talking to the school about it, and these are ways that, you know, my child might miss school sometimes because of medical appointments, or like down here in Florida, it's really hot. So the heat intolerance and making sure their fluids are well regulated is really important for a lot of our patients. So like some of them can't go outside for recess when it's really hot out. And so kids recognize that change, right? Like, why aren't they outside for recess, or why are they inside? So like giving them the opportunity of doing some in-school education, a lot of times they'll go and work with the classroom and the teachers who are kind of like, I have no idea what this means. Like, oh, this is really helpful to know. But a lot of times parents are the best experts on their kids or their conditions. And because each mitochondrial condition is so rare and unique, really families are the experts. So I think just being open and sharing that with the schools and letting kids know, like, this isn't anything you can catch from Johnny. Like, you know, because Johnny has this, that doesn't mean it's like COVID. I think COVID has really brought a lot of like hypervigilance to what communicable diseases are now. And so I found just reinforcing that with kids is important. A way I love to teach genetics is through this book. It's called Cells, Genes, and Protein Machines. This is actually through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But it is a great book that talks about DNA, and I teach mitochondria through this. And another way to implement that is with gummy worms. So I make gummy worms look like the genes, you know, that we're actually working with in the chromosomes, and then talk about, hey, if you have this, this is because on this chromosome, this mitochondria was impacted, or maybe it's missing a piece. And if it's missing a piece, like, I'll have them bite the end of it off. And like,
I'm sure you really have a hard time getting them to do that, right?
Right, exactly. So it's just a fun way to kind of like, again, take these very broad abstract concepts and using play to help make it a reality in a way they can understand.
Now, that book that you just shared, the Cells and Protein Machine book, can you get that through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services? Can you get it on Amazon?
Amazon, yeah, you can get it through Amazon. It's only like $6, which is great. I actually found it in my university library. Originally, I got a free copy through them, but you can get it on Amazon and it's only $6.
That seems like an essential book for families to have in the home.
It is.
You know, something we've talked about before is the idea of hope. And you had such beautiful ideas surrounding this. And I think we should end on this topic and really soak in these ideas so we can pass on these feelings to our children, whether they're affected personally with mito disease or a sibling or, you know, another relative or friend.
I think what we talk about a lot in pediatric hospice and palliative care is everybody hears like those words and thinks, oh my gosh, everybody's dying and like it's angels of death. And this diagnosis automatically means a death sentence, and it doesn't. Does it mean that your life can look different from the day you find out? Absolutely. But I think what we always try to encourage families is the things we hope for can take shape in different forms. So sometimes we hope like, okay, I'm sure Marcy, from what I've heard from you, I hope my children aren't traumatized when I tell them that I have mitochondrial disorder. I really hope my children don't have this, of course, right? I hope that they aren't scared. I hope that they, you know, I hope that they don't think I'm failing them if they notice that something's wrong when I'm, you know, not able to hide it. I hope that they, you know, don't have all these fears about their grandmother, their great grandmother. Like, those are all things that you hope for, right? But as our families get these diagnoses and then they live with it, it's like, okay, I hope for the best quality of life. Like, I hope that, you know, with this family with the 10 kids who have 4 of them impacted by this condition, 2 of them severely, it's okay. I hope the oldest one still has joy in working, you know, in every day, despite everything he goes through. Like, I hope we can get him to go see family upstate. And we do. So it's just like, okay, we're going to get him in the car. Like, we're going to load him up. All right. And he goes and they do it. And so I think the way they had originally envisioned this, you know, their lives with this young man, it's not at all what they had hoped for. with the severity of his disease progression. But at the same time, they've done a really beautiful job of honoring the hope in every day in giving him the best quality of life, and the siblings being able to be around him and help him and care for him and just live day in, day out as a family of, this is who we are. This is how it just is. And so, you know, they moved his bed out of a bedroom into the middle of the living room. And he's an integral part of every day instead of being isolated in a bedroom that, you know, nobody could, he couldn't be in the middle of life.
He's visited more often.
Yeah. Oh, he's in the heart of it all day, every day. And so I think that's really important, is honoring how hope can shift and change. And that doesn't mean that that's not sad when sometimes it isn't what we hoped, you know, but still giving hope the space to exist and thrive in a situation that we never hope to be in the middle of. I think it's constantly checking in on what that hope looks like, knowing that hope shifts over time.
You have shared so many wonderful ideas. I feel like if I was a listener, and even just right now, I've been taking so many notes of things, you know, one-liners and ideas that I want to talk to my husband about in terms of talking to our kids, and ideas that I want to incorporate more into our house. You talk so beautifully on the topic, and families are so lucky to have you in their, you know, realm of care. And thank you for being a part of our show. This won't be the last that you've heard, you know, with Danielle. There's so many topics that we can explore together in terms of taking care of families that are going through this. So please, please stay in our lives, stay in our organization. And we look forward to having you on in the future. Thank you so much, Danielle. I really appreciate you sharing with us.
Thank you, Marcy. And I just want to thank all the families I've been honored and blessed to learn from and to walk with. It has been just so enlightening, not only on what mitochondrial condition is, but how to live with a life that they never dreamed, but how to still have beauty and hope in every day. They've taught me so much, and I just continue to learn from them. I think we're all mosaics of all the experiences and the people we meet, and I think it just continues to evolve. But I'm honored to get to learn more about you and your family and your wonderful organization here, which I will be sharing with all of my families. So I hope that you all can partner together. And I've approached a few of my families too about sharing their story. So I think you'll hear some more from them too.
We would love to have them. Well, thank you, Danielle, and we look forward to having you back soon.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I'm so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.